We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Dive to the mailbag, Ryan. Has some really good questions today about a lot of different topics. Timeout Tom says, I grew tired of the constant complaints of Notre Dame's weak schedule, but over the BK years, the schedule did seem to get weaker. Was it a coincidence or was it a purposeful and arranged at Jack Swarbrick or BK's request? I'm going to speak to this first, Ryan, and you let me know if you have some more you want to add. It was partly not in their control. I think Notre Dame did the right thing in softening their schedule to make it more reasonable. I don't think they intended for their schedule to be soft the way that it has turned out to be. And the reason it's been soft is in recent years, Stanford and USC have bottomed out. In 2017, they played 8 ranked teams that year. Well, part of that was because Stanford was a 9-win team that year and USC was an 11-win team that year. Right. And so that helped them. But like in 2019, Notre Dame went 1-2 against ranked opponents. They beat Navy, lost to Georgia and Michigan. Stanford and USC didn't finish ranked. 2021, Stanford and USC both had losing records. 10 years ago, even in the early 2010s, even though USC was a bit inconsistent, they were still at worst an 8-5, 9-4 type of team. And then they had a couple really good 10, Lane Kiffin wasn't, for all the crap that Lane Kiffin took. He was still a way better coach than Clay Helton during his USC period. I mean, he had, two 10-win seasons at USC, correct? Yeah, no, I mean, he got fired. They were 3-2. Yes, he had one 10-win season. He went 8-5, 10-2, 7-6, and then he went 3-2. And that year that he went 3-2, they still finished 10-4. Yeah. And then, of course, Sark comes in the next year, and they go 9-4 the next year. They go 8-6 the next year, which was a rough year. They lost a lot of close games, but then they broke back out in 16 and went 10-3. And then in 2017, they went 11-3. So their down years were like a couple 7-6 and 8-6 seasons. Those were sandwiched around 9, 10, 11 win seasons. Well, under Clay Helton, the bottom fell out in recent seasons. The last few years, they went 5-7, 8-5, 5-1 during a COVID year. And then last year, they were 4-8. So I think
who could have predicted that it would have been bad under Clay Helton?
I know, right? Shocker. Yeah. And then Stanford's been just bad. Yeah. And so I think those two things have really hurt Notre Dame. And I think the ACC kind of fallen off a cliff. Because if you look at last year's schedule, if 6-7 years ago, like if in 2015, I would have told you in 2021, Notre Dame is going to start the season off with a road game against Florida State. They're going to play Wisconsin on a neutral field in Chicago. They're going to have USC. They're going to have Stanford. Do they hate Brian Kelly? Oh, and you got Cincinnati at home on that schedule too? Like, do you guys hate your coach? Are you trying to get him fired? Like, that's what you would have thought, 13, 14, 15, because Wisconsin was 10-plus win every year. Florida State was 2 years away from having won a national championship and then a playoff appearance, right? I mean, you'd have been like, man. Like, you guys are, USC was coming off of a couple really good seasons. You'd have thought, boy, this is going to be a brutal schedule.
Yeah.
And then you look at it, and it turns out not to be that way. So I think the ACC really bottoming out and COVID and then USC, Stanford. And the reason I say COVID is because the 2020 schedule was going to be a lot tougher, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, Wisconsin was going to be pretty good that year, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, you had Florida State on your schedule, who wasn't that good. You'd had USC, and USC was better in 2020 than they were in 2021, right? I mean, they were 5-1, but they weren't that good. But they would have been a winning team that year. So I think you had Arkansas. You know, would at least been tough, you know, been physical, whatever. But I mean, that schedule would have been tougher than what it turned out to be. It turned out to be Clemson and a bunch of nothing, if we're being honest about that season. What North Carolina at 8-4 was your second best team. That would not have been the case if it wasn't for COVID. Because Wake Forest was pretty good in 2020, and that game kept getting canceled. And they would have been on Notre Dame's schedule as well. So I think those are the things that have factored into it, is an intentional softening coupled with the ACC going down and USC and Stanford being pretty bad the last 5-6 years. I think are the reasons why.
It's good analysis. Opinion.
I don't think it was intentional. Hey, let's make it soft. Let's make it weak so I can pad my stats. I think that was a benefit to it, but I don't think that was Jack Swarbrick's intention.
No.
You know, I don't.
That's some of the dangers of like scheduling so far out too, right? It's just like, you can't predict the future at that point. Right. I mean, like you said, a lot of those teams were either riding good momentum or they looked like they were about to take the step forward again. And, you know, just some of it has just not worked out. Unfortunately, a lot of it has not worked out, but that's not Notre Dame's fault necessarily. That just is you're a victim of circumstance at that point.
Right. So. Yeah, agree. Cause like, I mean, you know, you could look at Notre Dame's 2029. So I'm like, wow, you guys got to play Alabama in 2029. You know, oh wow, 2030, you guys got to play at Alabama. I have no idea what Alabama is going to look like in 2030. I don't know what I'm going to look like in 2030. I don't, you know, much less who's no. I don't know if anyone associated with the program right now is going to be with either team in 2030. You know, so just like in 2013, we'd have looked at the 2021 start to the season, and you got to start at Florida State. Good luck with that. You know, but then of course when you get to it, they're just not good. So you're right. That's why I hate this. I mean, your schedule just filled for 5-6 years in advance. I'm not a big fan of that. I'm not a big fan of that.
2030, I'm going to look exactly the same. That's all I can say.
You have a 1-year-old girl. I can assure you, you are not going to look the same in 2 years. Look
exactly the same. You have no. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to become a victim of time, sir.
This is a saved recorded podcast that I will be able to look back on in 10 years and be like, "Hey Ryan, you remember when you said you'd look the same? Let's revisit that.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Let's go to Notre Dame 2164. Is anybody else a little surprised that Rocco isn't further along? I know people develop at different rates, but I thought he would be ready to play in his second year. Am I expecting too much? I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. Ryan, I know you weren't super high on Rocco coming out. So just where are you right now? And then also the fact that you got to remember, he's got a sixth year senior and a fifth year team captain projected as a potential first round pick ahead of him as well.
Right. Guard. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some circumstance. It's not like he's competing against nobody. Right. But right. I would say this, and this was my opinion on Rocco coming out. I thought Rocco Spindler was a good player, but Brian, I know we talk about the fact that offensive line evaluations from high school mm-hmm. can get tough sometimes because some guys are just physically more mature at a certain age and they're more dominant. And I mean, when I saw Rocco Spindler's highlight tape, I was like, wow, that dude is bullying people, you know, mm-hmm. but you didn't see a ton of like working in space, working right. laterally. You just saw kind of the physicality.
You saw the wrestling background is what you saw.
Which is great. I mean, that's very well needed. But I think that the transition that you're finding is tough for Rocco is I'm not sure that he's a great athlete. I think he's a very tough football player. I think he's got a lot of physicality. But you need a little bit more than that to transition properly to the college level. So it's not – I mean, like, we're not jumping off and saying, like, Rocco was not going to be a good football player at Notre Dame. I mean, he's a redshirt freshman, right? So, like, he's got plenty of time. The fact mm-hmm. of the matter is that there's from a flexibility foot quickness perspective, I think there just needs to be kind of a there needs to be a mission for Rocco Spindler here mm-hmm. moving forward to get more efficient in those areas. If he can, he can play football, and I think he can play good football for Notre Dame. It's just I think he's one of those kids that was just maybe a little more physically advanced at an age, but sure. maybe the upside isn't tremendous. So we'll sure. see.
USMA 87. There's been some talk about Tyler Buckner's throwing motion. To me, it looks like his release is low. What is your assessment? How will it impact Reese's playbook? Number one, that is one of the most useless things that people in the media try talking about all the time is people's throwing motions. And I'll never understand it. And my whole thing is I don't care what a guy's motion looks like as long as it gets where it needs to get to. Yes. Tyler is always going to be a from-the-ear guy. He was that way in high school. As he's tinkered with it, he stayed that way. He's always going to be that kind of guy. The other thing is Tyler is will change his arm angle, and that's something Notre Dame practices with him. They work on that, and they need to work on that. You can't be an RPO team if your quarterback, unless you have a 6'5", 6'6", quarterback, if your quarterback can't change arm angles. So it doesn't bother me. As long as he's accurate with it, I don't care what his throwing motion looks like. I would never, ever, ever, ever teach a quarterback how to throw like Phillip Rivers. I would also never teach Phillip Rivers to change his throwing motion. Right. I mean, that's the reality of it. So how does it impact his playbook? To me, it doesn't at all. It doesn't impact it at all.
Why would it? I mean, I agree with you. I think it's again, and you use it's like you're in my mind sometimes, but I was going to bring up Phillip Rivers as like the prime example, right? Like he looked like he was a shot putter. Like you don't want to ever look like that when you're in your throwing motion, but to your point, and I cannot agree more with it. As long as it gets from point A to point B in a good amount of time with some sort of, you know, urgency to get in the football there, I don't care about I don't care what the arm angle is. I don't care what the release point is. I care that it gets there efficiently and effectively. So, yeah, I would not change it. And, I mean, my question would be more to this question is, why would it change something in Tommy Reese's playbook? I don't understand quite. The only way that, like, because it's not the fact of, like, and motion, like if Tyler Buckner, for instance, had a below average arm, for instance, right, and he wasn't able to push the ball vertically or something, let's say, then that might cut part of the playbook out, right? Because there might be mm-hmm. some throws that you just can't make. But that's not because of the motion. That's more a deficiency of arm strength. And I don't think that Tyler Buckner has a deficiency of arm strength. I think he just has a somewhat awkward, different release, which, okay, I can deal with that.
Sure. I think there's also this perception that, you know, you got to be tall because you got to throw over guys. Quarterbacks rarely throw over defensive linemen unless it's a downfield throw, and then your trajectory doesn't matter anyway. That throwing angles have been a thing for decades. As long as I've been playing quarterback, and my first year playing football was seventh grade, but I studied football and watched football. Quarterbacks don't throw over guys on 5-yard crossing routes. I don't care if you're 6'9". Dan McGuire wasn't throwing over guys on crossing routes. If you remember him, Ryan, that's a little blast from the past. Mark McGuire's brother, he was like, 6'8", 6'10", something absurd like that. He was not throwing over guys on a crossing route. He was throwing in a throwing lane. And I think that's the kind of perception is that, well, you know, he's only 6'1.5". He's got a low throwing motion. He's going to get a lot of balls batted down. Yeah, if he's trying to throw over guys on short throws, yes, that's going to happen. But it's not a concern. But that's why he works on the arm angles. That's why Tommy Rees is working with the arm angles, because if you do have a guy screaming off the edge and you got to get that little now screen out there, you throw that sucker sideways and get it out there to him. Sure. If that's what you got to do. And Tyler has shown a proclivity to that. I mean, what were the Simses working on with Jack Cohn last year and their summer workouts? You saw them working on trying to get Jack to be able to change his arm angles. I think it was a little too late for Jack to really be able to do that with any effectiveness. Tyler's always been that kind of guy. Tommy Rees is trying to create it to where we're going to keep doing what you do, but we're going to make it a little bit more consistent. And I think that's the objective with what they're trying to do. So it doesn't
matter. And especially with the arm angle stuff, it's – look, there used to be like this big stigma around, you know, smaller quarterbacks can't play because of the same thing, Brian. It's like, oh, they're going to get so many passes batted down. That's not a problem for Russell Wilson. That's not really a problem for Kyler Murray either, because they can throw from those arm angles. They can find those passing windows, right? So as long if it's not a problem, don't make it a problem is where I tend to kind of go with this stuff, right? Like if height isn't an issue, don't make it an issue. If his release point isn't an issue, don't make it an issue. Like that's just kind of my stance is usually like if something's not necessarily a negative on film, I'm not going to make it a negative.
I like that. If something's not a negative on film, I'm not going to make it. Okay, that's beautiful.
I'm not going to try to fix something.
That's no, I think that's perfectly. I love it. I'm just like letting it sink. Like that's so brilliant. Jared Rhodes, Brian and Ryan, with all the good players Notre Dame is getting to commit, what do we have to look forward that will be noticeably different in games? Is it just size and speed, or a bit more to it than that?
I think that size and So, Jared, my opinion is that you'll be able to see the differences, right? Like, you'll see that size and speed, but from a coaching perspective, it's how they're able to better utilize size and speed, right? Because it's like the little nuances, and we just talked about, like, how much of a playbook's going to be cut if an arm strength isn't great, for instance, right? The ability to have speed and added size is going to open up a world of possibilities. You might try something schematically that you would have never tried in the past because you did not have the players that could make it properly a tangible thing to try. But I think that for me, Brian, is the biggest thing, is that it just allows for more possibilities. When you have added size, you have added speed, you have a higher margin for error at that point. Like you can try things. That opens up possibilities, I think, for coaches. So, yes, I think you can see the added size and speed on the field, Jared. But I think more than anything, you're going to see things on the field from a coaching perspective. You're going to be like, huh, that's unique. That's a different type of play. That's a different type of formation. I haven't seen that staple in the offense before. I haven't seen that blitz in the defense before because you now have more possibilities with that increase in talent.
I think there's other things, too. I think the increase in talent means you have more guys that can wreck games. More guys can take over a game. It doesn't have to be the same guy every time. I think more speed is something we'll see. It's a situation where, you know, Notre Dame's got some fast guys now. Overall, they got speed and all these other type of things. But I think it'll even be more dynamic speed moving forward. It'll be even more difference makers and bigger speed. I think that's the thing. Like, so I think it'll be noticeable when you watch Notre Dame play that they have, because I think there's still spots where Notre Dame doesn't have great speed.
Yeah.
You know, and even some of their you know, like J.D. Bertrand's a good athlete. There's that kind of athlete. And then there's a Drake Bowen type of athlete. Right. I mean, it's just, it's like, you know, I'm not making excuses for Notre Dame because J.D. Bertrand, when it comes to athleticism, kid can get it done. But then, but then there's like another level of it. And then Drake Bowen's like 6'2", 230 right now. Like Drake Bowen is probably as big, if not bigger, than J.D. Bertrand is right now.
Right.
You know, and that's the difference for me. And so I think those will be things that you see. More game wreckers, more depth of speed. And another place I think you're going to see an impact that Ryan is on special teams. I think it's going to make Notre Dame's special teams really dynamic, coverage-wise and return-wise.
100%. I think also for me, I was just working on the mailbag earlier, you know, trying to get it out. And Brian, somebody asked me about who are some players in the 2023 class that I think could be like incredible testers if they make it to like the NFL draft scene, right? And I was starting to think, I think also the body types of what, excuse me, the coaching staff likes in a certain position is going to change incredibly quickly too. Because I was even thinking, like, in a couple of years from now, you could have an interior defensive line, let's say maybe 3 years from now, where a 6'4", 290-pound Tyson Ford is next to a 6'5", 300-pound Brennan Vernon, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think the body types are also of what...
I think that's a good one. Just size. Yeah, length. Because the D-line right now is a little... it's undersized. It is.
Sure.
Now, I think they can compensate for it, but I think that's a great point, because what you're going to see moving forward is Notre Dame will not lose anything athletically with Bubakar and with Tyson Ford and Danny Gobira and Keon Keeley and Brennan Vernon and Devin Houston and all those guys. They won't lose a thing athletically. Brandon Davis Swain is 6'4". You won't lose a thing athletically. But now you're going to have that in 6'4", 6'5", and 6'6", guys with long arms that are weighing 275, 285, 295. You're going to see a lot more Foskies and Millses than Howard Crosses and Jacob Lacy's and Jason Adamiolas. Again, excellent players, but it's excellent players that are now 6'4", 305, as opposed to 6'3", you know, 6'2", 280, or 6'1", 265, 275. That's the difference.
Yeah, and that's where I was going with it. It's like you have three guys as your top three defensive tackles right now who are all between 6 foot and 6'3", somewhere in that ballpark, and 265-ish to like 285, right? Like that's your interior defensive line. I think in just 3 years, you're going to be like, oh, wow, now we have 6'4", 6'5", 6'5", 285, 295, 300. Like I think the body types for me is just what's going to completely change. So you're going to be looking at a completely different prototype at different positions because I mean, I was even thinking, I mean, think about this, Brian, like I was talking about like who I felt could be an elite tester. And then I was like, one player that might be a surprise that's on this list is Brennan Vernon because Brennan Vernon at defensive end is a good athlete, but what if he's a three tech eventually? Then we're talking about him being an elite athlete inside. Right. And I think that's where the game is going, but I also think that's where Notre Dame is following in that suit too, is that's what they want. That's why we keep preaching. They want to be longer. They want to be more athletic everywhere. And that's why. That's where this game is going for Notre Dame, in my opinion.
Yep. I love it. Alan Watson with a super chat, or not super chat, but with a question. Alan said, hey, Ryan and Brian, question of the day. Who scores the first offensive and defensive touchdowns this year? Hopefully they both come early and often at Ohio State.
First offensive and first defensive touchdowns this year. I'm going to say, someone said yesterday on the show, I think it was Brandon, it may have been, that said that he sees Brandon Joseph getting an interception in that first game. So I'm going to say it's Brandon Joseph. Pick six, Brandon Joseph. Okay. Oh, yeah. That's the first defensive touchdown this year. I don't know who it's going to come against. Hopefully Ohio State. We'll see.
Yeah.
First offensive touchdown. I'm going to go with Tyler Buchner. I'm going to go Tyler Buchner keeps it for a touchdown, the first offensive touchdown of the year. So I'll go Buchner and Brandon Joseph, first offensive and defensive touchdowns this year.
I'm going to go defensively. I mean, I'm going to go with Marist, and I'll explain why in a second. There's a response by Mace AK that I want to address of why I'm going with Marist. And it's relative to Ohio State, not that it's going to be Marist, but I think what I think the first defensive touchdown would look like. Offensively, I'm really going to go with Chris Tyree. And that's more of a hope than it is a prediction. Because if Chris Tyree is the first guy to score on offense this year, that means he ripped off a big one against Ohio State, right? Like Chris Tyree is not going to score from the two. It's either going to be Estime, Diggs, or Buchner from the two, right? It's going to be if Chris scores, it's because he housed it. And that would be it would remind me, and I've said this before, I would love to see Notre Dame on its first drive or two, especially if it's its first drive, kind of do to Ohio State what they did to Oklahoma in 2012. You remember that when like Sierra just went right up the middle for like a 50-yard touchdown non-stop.
Oh yeah.
And you know, that would be a big momentum. That would be a big thing, because if you can rip off a big run and now force Ohio State to say, "Hey, we better put a little bit more in the box," now all of a sudden you can open up some stuff over the top and on the perimeter. I think that would be huge. So that's more of a wish than it is anything. Mace AK followed up. He said, "To be honest, instead of a pick six, I want to see a strip sack and a fumble return for a TD. I want Stroud running for his life," because it was referring to like the Oklahoma State game. I think what it would be is, in my opinion, it might be something like we saw against Georgia Tech last year, you know, where it was a pick six, like Jack Kaiser had a pick six against Georgia Tech, or was it Navy? It was Georgia Tech. But the pick six came on a play where I think it was Isaiah Foskey was drilling the quarterback. Yeah. You know, like I could see something like that where, you know, Stroud tries to quickly, he's getting hammered and tries to get rid of it. I think that kind of thing would even be more impactful because that kind of play, he saw it coming, mm-hmm. right? I want a quarterback seeing it coming and then rushes into a mistake. Because I think those kind of – and the reason I say that is, as a quarterback, those type of mistakes can hurt you more than a strip sack. Strip sacks are kind of rare. They don't happen. Dang it, I didn't see it coming. We got you next time. The ones that I think are when you're in a quarterback's head is when he sees it's coming and he's trying to, I don't want the ball in my hand because Foskey's coming again. And so it's something like where he's about to get drilled by Foskey or Adam Yoel or Riley Mills. And he just kind of like, oh, throws it quickly. And then Maris is there to pick it off a running back. That's how I kind of see that kind of going, that kind of thing. Or the other one is I have visions in my head of what we saw in the spring game where you try to throw a screen over one of Notre Dame's long edge guys and it has to float up there a little bit. And then Maris comes out and houses that sucker. So it's something like one of those two scenarios would be the one for me.
I love it. Hey, I'll say this about CJ Stroud too, Brian, just kind of reiterate your point. Is there were moments last year throughout the season where he had some really nice movement in the pocket. He's able to avoid rushes. But there are some points, man, where he does get a little bit of happy feet after he's kind of felt some pressure. So I'm hoping that Notre Dame is able to kind of get that pressure early on in the game. Because to your point, I think that could be extremely impactful for the entirety of it if they're able to.
Yeah. Connor Fitch, what year are your personal expectations for a chance at a title? I think we will be good this year, but need the 23 and 24 class in before we have a real shot, in my opinion. I don't agree. I'm not predicting Notre Dame to win a championship this year. I'm not. There's a lot they have to prove. But I don't think that this year they don't have a real shot. I think they have the talent to compete with teams. I think they have a schedule that can get them into the playoff with a loss. And I don't see any other teams that I've said this before. Do I think Bama's probably the best team in the country coming back? I do. Do I think Ohio State's really good? I do. Do I think that Georgia's still going to be really good? I do. None of them are 2019 LSU. None of them are 2018 Clemson. They're, in my opinion, they're not. Alabama's got a great quarterback. They've had a great quarterback for several years. That great quarterback doesn't have the weapons. And, you know, I know you've talked about Jermaine Burton and Tyler Harrell and all those guys, but you've admitted they're not Devontae Smith and Jerry Jeudy and the Henry Ruggs and Jalen Waddle receiving corps.
They're
not. Sure. Yeah. And those teams had four first-round picks on one unit. I don't know if Alabama has a first-round pick at wide receiver on this roster. I don't think Jermaine Burton showed last year he's a first-round pick. Now, Jamison Williams didn't show that he was a first-round pick coming in last year either, so it could change. But just what I know, and I just don't think Jermaine Burton is that kind of guy. Could be wrong. Having said that, this is still going to be a really good Bama team. It is. Is their defense what it was 5, 6, 7 years ago? No. Is it still should be pretty good? It should be pretty good, yes. Their offensive line going to be as good as it has been in past years? No. It should still be solid. It should still be good. They got a good O-line coach, good running backs, all that kind of stuff. This is not an unbeatable team. This isn't the team that Notre Dame played 2 years ago. It's not the team that Notre Dame played in 2012. There is no Clemson from 2018 this year, in my opinion. There isn't. And so, and this is, in my opinion, arguably Notre Dame's most talented team they've had in a number of years. Maybe we can argue that they don't have as many top-level players. I think that's debatable. I would actually disagree with that, but I've had people I know and trust say that to me. But you can't argue the depth of this team being better than what's been in past years. And so I just look at it and I say, I think this team has a shot to win a title this year. Am I predicting it? No. Am I putting my mortgage on it? Absolutely not. Do I think that we should just chalk this up as a year that they're not a title team? No. And I think next year might actually be more challenging for Notre Dame than this year because I think the schedule is going to be harder next year. And I also think that you're going to have some big losses next year personnel-wise that maybe you can replace, maybe not, but it's not going to just be a normal, okay, here we go, you're just reloading kind of thing. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where I'm at with that. I'm done with the whole wait till next year stuff. I'm done with it.
Yes.
Now, will the roster be better in 2024 than it is right now? I think it's got a good chance to be so, but I'm just not chalking this year up to being one that Notre Dame can't compete with it. Notre Dame on any given Saturday, I think, can hang with any team in the country. There's also some questions enough on their team that if they don't play their game, they could get smacked. But I think that's true for a lot of people.
Sure.
I mean, Alabama lost to Texas A&M last year. Come on. You know?
What was the quarterback's name again? He transferred to Auburn.
Zach Calzada or whatever
Calzada.
It is.
Calzada. Yeah, Calzada.
Yeah. Come on. Yeah. It's not like they lost to Johnny Football or even Bo Wallace for that, you know.
Wallace.
Yeah, they lost to Bo Wallace. Remember him?
I remember.
You know, it's like they lost to Zach Calzada last year. They almost lost to TJ Finley. End of sentence. Right? So, you know, there's a lot of good teams that to me right now, there are no of those. There's been a couple in the last 5 years, we've seen a couple of teams where you're like, that's one of the best teams I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Clemson 2018 was one of the best teams I've ever seen. LSU 2019 was one of the best teams I've ever seen. You don't see that in back-to-back years. That was not true last year. Bama 2020. I can't say it because it was such a weird year. The COVID stuff, Ohio State played 6 regular season games. It was just such a weird year. I kind of blocked that year out for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But last year, I've said this, Georgia would have got smacked by most of the teams that have won national championships the last 6 or 7 years, with all due respect. They got smacked by both of Clemson's title teams. They'd have got smacked by 2020 Alabama. They couldn't cover Jamison Williams and John Mechie. With all due respect, they're not Devontae Smith. Mm-hmm. Sorry. And, you know, they got smacked. They got destroyed by 2019 LSU. I'm sorry. Right. They would have.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just was one of those years. And I think this year is going to be closer to that than it is 2018, where you had 3 really good teams in college football that year, including Notre Dame. And like I've said this before, I think Notre Dame would have had a much better shot at winning if they could have been matched up with Bama in the first round than Clemson. Because Clemson was hands down the best team in the country that year, hands down. Mm-hmm. After Trevor had like 3-4 starts under his belt, they were going to be hard to beat. Very hard to beat.
Yep.
99 problems, but BK ain't one. Says, if yours is a dude this season, I could see Texas being top couple, meaning ranked high. And he says, they have a dude at running back, a dude at receiver. I'm not that familiar with the rest of their team, though. That's kind of my point, right?
Yeah.
You can't say that if you only know of the fact that they have a dude at receiver and running back. I mean, their defense, I think, again, I think Texas could win the Big 12, and I have them as kind of a playoff sleeper if they can, you know, lose competitively against Alabama and then run the table against an okay Big 12. Mm-hmm. But they got a lot of holes they got to fill, you know? I mean, and to the point to where 99, they could end up being that team in the end, but I don't think you can justify that preseason. Because even if Ewers is a dude, Ryan, who's blocking for him?
Well, that's
who's stopping the other team? That's the big question mark.
Well, that's my biggest thing is because I've actually dug into their defense, especially this. I mean, we know offensively. What I mean, because all right, let's start with the positives to 99 Problems point. Bijan Robinson, 99, is absolutely a dude. There's no doubt. We've talked about Xavier Worthy on this show before, and I know that Brian's talked a lot about how he thinks he might be the best receiver in college football.
I think he will be this year.
So if he is, that's fantastic. They got Isaiah Nayer, transfer from Wyoming, who's a really good wide receiver. They have Jordan Whittington, who's a good slot receiver. I like
him. He's their Avery Davis, in my opinion.
Yeah. He's a good football player. You have almost nothing returning on the offensive line. You have a lot of young kids, and the one key starter coming back offensively from an offensive line perspective is Christian Jones, who is a very not good offensive tackle. We'll just leave it at that. Right.
And their young players aren't Blake Fisher. And Joe Walt, I don't think.
I don't think so either. And defensively, they have a couple names. Like they have DeMarvian Overshown, who has a name recognition thing, and a couple defensive linemen. But for the most part, their defense has been very bad over the last couple years. So are they going to be able to turn that thing around? I mean, that's my biggest thing is that you're weak in some very troubling spots. Offensive line-wise, not great. Defensively, it's also not very good in Texas right now. But to that point, I don't think the Big 12 is going to be great this year. And you have the makings of something good. It's just about how quickly can Steve Sarkisian get in this offensive line working? Can the defense at least be solid? If the defense can be solid, your offensive line is okay. Nothing terrible.
then your wife, I mean, then your playmakers are your playmakers. You have a lot of talents, but a lot of questions still to work out.
Like, you know, Notre Dame has questions and young linemen and all this kind of stuff, but they're a team that has those questions coming off of an 11-2 season. Right. Texas has those questions coming off of a 5-7 season. There's a difference. And that's why I'm not able to go there with you right now.
Yeah.
Can't go there with you. John A1 says, see Batelho working a lot with D-line edge groups on various practice vids so far. Has Kaiser or someone else stepped up at the Rover position? My understanding is he is going to get some of those edge moments. It doesn't necessarily mean he is playing that exclusively, but I'll definitely look into it, John. I don't think that has as much to do with Jack Kaiser stepping up, because I think Jack Kaiser's already stepped up. I think that has more to do with there are going to be situations where they want to get Jordan coming off the edge. I think that's what it has to do with more than anything else.
I'm happy to hear that, sir. Yeah. Very happy to hear that.
I agree. Josh Buffo, the motivational business banker. They were talking about Georgia and kind of all those type of things. He said he was agreeing with Archer. I agree. I don't think Georgia can recover from losing the players they lost on D to win this year. To me, it's wide open, Bama and everyone else right now. I do think it's wide open. I do. And I don't think it's Bama and everyone else. I think it's wide open, period. As I've said before, give Ohio State a full season to get their new coaches going. And I would love to see Ohio State and Alabama play in the postseason. As a Notre Dame person, I'm not afraid of Notre Dame in a matchup against Alabama now, like I was a couple years ago or past years, where everything has to go right for Notre Dame. Because you know what? Notre Dame's got some dudes on defense that can do damage against Alabama, just like Alabama has some guys that can do damage to Notre Dame. Notre Dame has some offensive weapons that can give matchup problems for Alabama, just like Alabama has some. And the reason I say that is if Notre Dame is a playoff team, the stuff we were talking about earlier about Tyler Buchner worked out. Yes. And then I'll put them against anybody. Now, they got to play their best game? Yeah. But they don't need a bunch of breaks to go their way like they did a couple years ago in 2020. Mm-hmm. To win, you had to have some stuff go your way. And I don't think that's the case. I don't think anyone is hands down better than everybody else this year. I don't. I think there's a group of teams that are significantly better than most other teams, but they're all even still down the pack a little bit more than maybe what it was a couple years ago. That's my two cents.
After seeing the poll, it does seem like parity's a little high in this poll this year. I don't know if that's just me with nearsightedness or not, but it does seem like there's not a huge separation. Because, I mean, even – like you were talking about, Brian, like, you know, you would still have Georgia maybe as number one just because they're the defending national championship. Sure. But we're talking about maybe them taking a step back because they have so much turnover, not only a defensive coordinator, but also with how much talent they lost in the season. So it seems like parity may be at an all-time high this year.
Like I said, I would have them number one, but this is a year where I'm not going to argue with them not being number one, right? Because you have a head coaching change and – you know, and I do buy the thing of Dan Lanning, you know, leaves. They're going to be okay because it's like when Kirby left, I was like, Alabama's defense is going to be okay. Now, the interesting thing is Alabama's defense has never actually truly recovered from Kirby being gone, which to me says a lot about, okay, Kirby's a better defensive coach maybe than I gave him credit for, because I gave Saban a lot of the credit for how good their defense was, and he deserved it, but they've never been as good as they were when Kirby was their D coordinator. Now, there's other reasons why. They play a different style of offense now, right? Sure they do. Score quicker. It puts their defense in more binds. The game has changed. All those type of things. And so I do think that factors into it, but I don't think Dan Lanning was necessarily a guy that I'm like, oh, geez, they can't replace him. It's more of they lost all the linebackers. And honestly, defensive linemen they lost, I'm not worried about it. Like, to me, they're fine. The question for me is, can they recover from not having to Kobe Dean and Channing Tindall. And then who's the other kid that they had at linebacker?
Quay Walker.
I think those are going to be some bigger losses. And then Lewis Cine is another guy that I think is going to be a bigger question mark for me than losing the guys up front. But even then, they're replacing those guys with really good players, or at least talented players. And I would still argue that their most talented defensive lineman or defensive player from last year is back.
The most talented player, just in general.
Jalen Carter's a stud. Yeah, and Nolan Smith's a really good football player. And
Robert Beal let him in sacks last year. So, Kaylee Ringo's back.
And he's 27, you know, Josh Beal. Yeah. So he's been around forever. But, so that's kind of the thing. So, anyway. John A1 says Oklahoma's becoming very weird under Venables. Very Harbaugh type feel over there now. And we're not I don't think John and I'm not going to address the situation going on with Cale Gundy. That's not really, I don't know a lot about it. I'm not touching it. It's not my business because I don't know as much about it or what happened. Sure. But yes, when you just look at how Venables carries himself and how he talks and some of the quotes he has, there's definitely a Jim Harbaugh type of weirdness to him.
He's a strange fella, man. There seems like there's a little bit of a obliviousness too there.
Yeah,
but don't want to touch too much on it, but I'll say, I mean, Brian, we talked about this when he was hired. I think I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a huge fan of the hire. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I like Brent Venables as a defensive guy. I think he's a really smart in that capacity. I mean, I would take him as my defensive coordinator any day of the week. Like, I think he's a really smart defensive guy. And he has the ties to Oklahoma, which I understand, again, why that was their target. There's just something about him from a personality perspective that just does not say head coach to me. Like, I'll just leave it at that. Just doesn't say head coach to me.
I will say this, if you are wrong, and this is the thing I've always said, I don't know what he's going to be as a head coach, but if you're wrong and he can actually be a head coach, I think Oklahoma is going to be better under him than Lincoln Riley. And the reason I say that is because they're going to be better defensively, and I think he made a good hire as an offensive coordinator. I didn't know a lot about Jeff Lebby when he got hired, but as I've studied him since then, I'm like, okay, that's a good hire. I like that.
It was a really good hire. It was a really good hire. Agree 100%. Right. Yep.
But it's just the weirdness factor is the thing for me. And can he create a disciplined, tough program? That's, we don't know with a first-year coach. We have no idea. Yeah. But he's a weird guy. He's going to say a lot of really weird things. And it's just going to be like, I don't see him having the ability to turn it off. I just think that's who he is.
Yeah.
So
he gives me like vibes of, he's somewhere between Jim Harbaugh and Adam Gase for me. Like, there's just some weirdness.
The creepy eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Like, because Venables is kind of a scary looking guy too, man. Like, he's got kind of that vibe to him. I'm just like, I don't know if I want to talk to you, sir. Like, I'm sure you're a very nice man, but like, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it works out.
Yep. Derek Hart said, had to adjust my lunch schedule to catch you guys. Will you be starting at 1 for the foreseeable future? Just need to let everyone know I am now addicted to Notre Dame football in a different way. I appreciate that, Derek, very much. So in the past, we've had to adjust our schedule during the school year to fit Vince. But with the new format of what we've got going on Irish Breakdown with the night shows and some different things going on, Vince is going to be doing more of the stuff at night with Sean Stiers on the IB Nation Sports Talk, which we will have live tonight at 6:00, remind you. And then Vince will also be on the Friday mailbags for part of it when his schedule works, most likely. There may be some things to keep him off the mailbag. We'll see. But he'll still be on the College Morning Show, and then the post-game show, and then the Upon Further Review on Sunday, where the teaching schedule doesn't impact that. Because I didn't want to keep moving the schedule around during the year, and sometimes it's 12:30, and sometimes it's 1. So with Vince not on the afternoon show and doing more of the night stuff, which I love because he's doing a great job with Sean, and we'll still have him on the weekend stuff, that's going to allow us to continue to be at 1 o'clock. So we're going to stay at 1 o'clock during the season. And then, of course, you know, Mondays will be a recruiting hour. We're not, as I said yesterday, we're not going to be doing recruiting hour the next couple of weeks because there's just not a lot going on. And we answer recruiting questions in the mailbags. And if news does come up, we'll just address it on whatever day that it comes up, like we did yesterday. And then once the season starts, we'll get back to Monday being a recruiting hour episode. And we've got some plans for that. And then, of course, Ryan and I, and we'll have some other different guests, hopefully, during the season on the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday stuff where we'll break down the opponent, break down the team. So we will stay at 1 o'clock for the foreseeable future. If we decide that moving it to noon or 2 or whatever makes it better where more people want to watch it, that's fine. We can address that. But we've really found that 1 o'clock has been a sweet spot for us, and we want to keep it there as much as we can. So, yes, let those people know. Let your work know that's the hour you got to have it. You have at least have off for that first hour. And we're going to do more mailbag stuff this year than we did last year. We won't be doing like 3-hour shows during the season. There's just too much going on, but we're not going to just eliminate the mailbags like we did last year. We're going to try to find a happy medium between the two is what we're going to continue to try to do.
And Derek, if you do miss any shows, make sure that you're subscribed. Anybody out there, make sure you're subscribed that you get the notifications that we are going live, or you can catch the show afterwards as well.
And you can definitely listen on the podcast because now when these shows are over, we used to save them and then put them up the next morning. Well, now that IB Nation Sports Talk is taking that slot, we are then, as soon as this show is over, I will download it, clean it up, edit it, take out the part where Ryan was talking about somebody's granddaughter, and then we'll publish that. So it'll come up that day. And so you can listen to those, because I think we look better on the podcast than we do the live YouTube show. At least I do anyway. So definitely have the face that fits that better. There's no question about it. You can't see my face. All right. Josh Buffo, the motivator. And Derek, thank you for that, because that actually allows me to let people kind of know a little bit about what's kind of going into our plans moving forward. And then also we will launch the college football pregame show a couple weeks early. So that 10 to noon slot on Saturday, we'll have a couple shows before the first week of the season. So we're definitely going to have one week zero. And what we'll do is we'll preview the games that day. It's not a lot of great games, but then there's some games during the week that are going to be pretty decent. Like Pitt plays Penn. Pitt and West Virginia play in that first week, like on a Thursday or something like that. Right. Sounds I think the right. Backyard Brawl is that first week, but it's on like a Thursday. Well, we're not going to have that show on a Thursday. So we'll preview even though the upcoming games on that show, and then, you know, do like a preseason thing. We'll have like a Notre Dame big picture preview the week before that. So start marking your calendar 2 weeks before the season opener against Ohio State. We will start that 10 to 12 slot for the show, the college football Saturday show. Then Archer says losing 7 draft picks on the defense is a lot to overcome for anyone. I think the thing that people are not giving enough credit to for Georgia is I don't think we put enough on how beat up their offense was last year. Mm-hmm. And I still have question marks about their receiving core, Ryan, because of Burton leaving mm-hmm. and because Pickens is gone, but they should be really good at tight end. Yes. They should still have some running backs that can catch the football. And they do have some players at receiver. They're not devoid of talent at wide receiver. They have some players there.
Trivia. Do you know who their leading wide receiver was last year? Brock Bowers is the leading overall receiver.
As far as just catches?
Yards and catches.
Yards? It wasn't. Burton was the leader in receptions behind Burton in receiving yards, excuse me. And then McConkey was their leading receiver in catches after the tight end. So it was different.
Gotcha.
Guys. Yeah. So, but your point stands. He's back. And he's like their Hunter Renfro. And he's a pretty good athlete. He's their Hunter Renfro. So, and I'm not saying that because he's white. I'm saying that because that's kind of the role. He's just that he doesn't catch the ball a lot, but when he does, it's a clutch catch.
Yep.
And they, you know, they have Adonai Mitchell comes back. I believe Kyrus Jackson is back.
Kyrus Jackson is back. Yep.
And they've recruited some good players at wide receiver in recent years. So they'll be okay there.
Eric Gilbert's apparently playing wide receiver at 265 pounds. So
whatever. I'm so tired of talking about that guy. Let me see him do something, right? Like, let me see him back. You know, I mean, I hope he gets whatever issues he's had worked out. That's great. But, like, let's let the kid go out and play before we start hyping him up as, like, the next greatest thing in the world. But I don't think Brock Bowers is going to get worse. You know what I mean? Like, a year stronger and in the system, I don't think he's going to get worse. And so, you know, I think their offense is going to be better. That's the key. And the other thing is Arian Smith healthy for them? That's going to be a big key because that dude can fly if he's healthy. So I'm not quite sure what his status is. I'd have to actually look into that. But if he's healthy, that's a dynamic. I mean, he is like a faster version of their Brayden Lindsey, but faster. Like, that kid can absolutely fly.
It's nice to have. And they have a couple, even though you lost Zamir White and James Cook, you still have Kenny McIntosh and what's the other kid's name? Kendall Milton coming back too, right? So, I mean, the running back stable is going to be talented. And the other point I'll say, Archer, about the 7 NFL draft picks, because I know that's mostly defensive players that we're talking about there. Yes, they're big losses. There's no doubt. But, I mean, everyone talked about Jordan Davis played less than 50% of the snaps, right? So, like,
way less. People
are playing.
Yeah. Way less than 50% of snaps.
And his career was only like 20-something percent or some crazy number like that.
He played way less than 20% of his snaps. And honestly, there were times he was just there. I mean, if we're being real, I mean – he would flash at times and put up those highlight reel plays, and they love showing it because he's just kind of a physical freak. But he was not, whatever. Don't get me started on that. So anyway, I think Georgia is going to be better on offense this year is the point. And they're still going to be pretty good on defense. They may not be the, you know, greatest defense ever nonsense like people were talking about last year, but they're still going to be really good on defense this year.
Quick comment. Did you see Jordan Davis's fantastic rep yesterday that everyone was gawking about? I'm just like, wow, he couldn't get off a block. Congratulations. Yeah. And he outweighed a guy by 100 pounds. Congratulations.
Yeah. Like, a buddy of mine pointed to the week that the Eagles play the Colts and said, he said, Notre Dame and and Jordan Davis matchup, which is going to be epic. But my I haven't responded to him yet, but I'm going to respond for like 12 snaps, for like 12, 15 snaps, because that's about all Jordan Davis can give you. You know, so that was I mean, he wasn't even in their top two last year for defensive linemen, in my opinion. Even when he was on the field, he would make some flashy plays, but his production was mediocre. And I know he's a two technique nose tackle, but he wasn't on the field a whole lot. So that guy replacing him won't exactly to me be the challenge that I think some people make it out to be. I could be wrong. I don't know. He played 378 snaps last year. I mean, in 15 games. That's an average in the 20s, Ryan. Yes. You know, so that'll be replaceable to me. I'm actually going to look at this. I want to compare this real quick. Hold on a second. Let me see. So that is fewer snaps. He played fewer snaps last year in games than Justin Adamiola. Right, he played just a few more snaps. What number did I say?
300 and something.
Right. Yeah. Let me look at that again, because I want to see how, because his numbers, let's put it this way, his numbers were a lot closer to Howard Cross than they were to Notre Dame starters last year. So let me just find this number real quick. So go down to the SEC and Georgia. So Jordan Davis last year played, where's he at? 378 snaps. Howard Cross played 330. So it's a much closer to that than he was to Notre Dame starters. Kurt Heinrich played 388 and only played 11 games.
Yes.
So in four fewer games, Kurt Heinrich played 10 more snaps than Jordan Davis did. So yeah, whatever. I think they'll be okay. Okay. And now you're going to see more of Jalen Carter this year too. And Nolan Smith's a good player too. Like, I got to watch more of him to really study him, but you know, he's a good player.
As a former coach, you'll like Nolan Smith. He does all the little things. I don't think he's a high upside pass.
Try hard kind of guy with a little bit of, with some talent.
Really strong hands, man. Good hand placement. Plays like a dog in the run game. Like you'll like a lot of what he does in that department. He's a great run defender. Great run defender.
All right, let's get to some more questions here. We have from Kerry Van Norman. How much will Notre Dame's defense change this year with Al Golden as DC, or do you think it will stay close to what Marcus Freeman had them doing last year?
I think, Kerry, you're going to see a baseline kind of structurally of what it's going to look like. I do think that you're going to see more four down with Coach Golden comparative to what you saw from Marcus Freeman last year. I thought Marcus played a lot of three down or kind of spurts in there, but I think that you're going to see more four down. But I will say, I think structurally it's going to be very similar. It's going to be, though, that Al Golden's going to have his little bit of touches on the defense, obviously, right? Like, it's going to be he's going to have the overall philosophy is going to be laid out, but then he's going to have kind of his version of it and his outlook on it, right? So I think it's going to be similar to what you saw last year structurally, but there will always be a couple of wrinkles that I think Al Golden's going to keep in there.
Notre Dame asks, good morning, fellas. So I hear that if you schedule Hawaii first game, then you can still schedule 12 more teams. Is that true? Going out to Hawaii every year is a good recruiting pitch too. Couple things about – I don't disagree, Damon. Couple things about that. I don't think you can schedule them every year. I think there's like – I'd have to go back and look at the rule again, but I think you can only do it like once every 3 years or something like that. And it's a non-conference game. You have to schedule a road game against them, and it's not week one. You just have to schedule a road game, period. And if you do that, you can play 13 games. So basically, if you go out there, they'll give you a home. The NCAA will give you a home game. And it's designed to try to encourage non-conference teams to go out to Hawaii. So that way, Hawaii doesn't have to play every non-conference game on the road. And so that's what they do. And some teams have taken advantage of that. I wouldn't be opposed to Notre Dame doing that. It's not something I would want to do every year, though. And I don't know if I would want to do it. I would actually, and I don't think this is possible because Hawaii plays in the conference they have the conference championship Mountain West, right? They're in the Mountain West.
Yeah.
But you know, if you could schedule it to where you'd play them the weekend of the conference championship games, or I think there's an exception for Navy and Army to be able to play the weekend they do, correct? Isn't there an exception to that?
I believe
so. If there was some way you could get an exception to play Hawaii that weekend, so then if Hawaii plays in the Big 12 championship, I'd be okay with that too. But I think most likely what you'd do is you'd have them play in week zero against Hawaii, or play them like play some, like, well, because what they could also do is they could schedule a home game against an independent team or something like that at home the weekend of the conference championship games. But the options for that wouldn't be overly attractive because then you'd have to have at Hawaii and then, you know, whoever they ended, like Liberty or who won't even be an independent that much longer. They could have done it with BYU, but that's not an option anymore after this year either. Yeah. So, because I'm trying to remember who is left on independent. It'd have to be like UConn, UMass. Teams that I'd be like, dude, I'd rather just stay at home. I wouldn't want to risk having an injury because as you're pounding, it's Army, it's BYU, who won't be after this year, Liberty, who is leaving for a conference either next year or the year after. I think they're joining a league soon. New Mexico State, UConn, and UMass. And honestly, I'd rather play an FCS team than play UConn or UMass. They're terrible.
How about New Mexico State? They're pretty bad, too. They're not great either. Yeah, but if playing Hawaii meant you get to go to Hawaii every once in a while, that'd be nice.
But I'd rather try to do some with Army. I mean, because you could schedule Army the week of the conference championship games, right? That could be a game.
And Army's actually a decent program right now. Like
Jeff Munkin's doing a nice job. He really is.
Yeah.
He really is.
Army may have the highest drafted player they've ever had, by the way. Yeah. They have
Andre You think Carter, that kid's a legit first round talent? You told me
maybe,
that, right?
Maybe not top 50 type of player.
Day two for sure. 50.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think their highest rated player that Army's ever had was Mike Wall went in the second round. So I think that Andre
Carter. And that was a while ago, wasn't it?
Yes, 90s, I think. Yeah, it was a long time ago now, but I think that he has a chance, man. He's got a nice little grade in the preseason, and he's long and athletic, and I don't know how Army got him, but they got him.
Yep. I got a super chat down here from Sean Michael. Thank you, Sean, very much for that. Hey, Brian and Ryan, thanks as always. You're welcome. If you're Tommy Rees, what's your first offensive series versus Ohio State look like? And then if you're Al Golden defensively, the same question. I'm going to go ahead and take a crack. I answered this last time and you agreed, but I'll let you kind of take your shot at this one, Ryan.
Yeah.
First series look like?
Yeah. I mean, Sean, for me, usually I want to kind of see how a defense, and I'm talking from Tommy Rees's perspective, I want to see how a defense is going to adjust to things, right? So if I'm coming, maybe I'll start with a 2x2 set and then I'll motion to a 3x1 just to see kind of what the adjustment is to a 3x1. And I might also do the same thing where I start in a 3x1. Motion to 2x2 and just kind of I want to see with movement on offensively what the defense and how they're going to adjust to it, right? And I want to see a couple different personnel groups. I'm just really trying to assess. I mean, I'm trying to score, right? Like I'm trying to get a drive going, but more than anything, when I'm an offensive team, I want to see defensively how do they adjust to certain formations, to movements. I want to see that type of thing. And I think honestly, against Ohio State, I'm going to try to run the football, right? Like, I think that's something where you are going to try to work this clock in your pace. So I might run some zone read out of it and see if I can bust one up the middle or if that overhang defender is going to crash into the box, then we have Tyler Buckner keep it. And then maybe off of that, I might run a little bit of pass action. So it's like an RPO type of look. Either way though, I want different looks almost every play. I want to see how they move to motion, and I want to run the football. That's what I'm doing early on. I want to set up a play action shot at some point, but in order for that to be extra effective, I need to be able to run the football on the ground. Defensively, it's a little tough. I mean, I am of the belief that defensively, coverage-wise, I want to mix in a lot of looks. And we talked a little bit about this, Brian. I think it was your post about, you know, just talking ball, and someone asked directly, like, how would you defend Ohio State or Jackson Smith and Jigba, I think, was the actual question. And I'm like, I would give a lot of man looks early on, but then I would rotate post-snap to different types of coverages, right? Because I want to kind of confuse the coverage and potentially funnel or even to have some robber coverage that's going to kind of rob the side that Jackson Smith is playing on. I want to really mix up the coverages a ton. And honestly, I'm going to pick my spots with some added pressure with, like, some five-man pressures. But I really, if I think Notre Dame is going to be successful, getting home with four, I think, is going to be incredibly important. If they're able to do that, then I can kind of mix and match my zone coverages. I'm going to play a little man in spurts, but I don't want to play man all day against this team. I want to be able to kind of mix and match the coverage. So that's a little bit of something I would do. More than anything, defensively, especially, Sean, I want to try to confuse this offense early from a passing game perspective. I want to force, hopefully – CJ Stroud into a little bit of some bad decisions early on. I think that's what would be, because if you get the run game going and maybe you force an early turnover, at least get him off his game, I think that's where you really start to take that momentum and take that pace in your advantage.
Let's go to the next question here. We have from Brent Smith. Actually, yes. Says, do you believe that the Frost Jabron Payne has to produce? And I assume he's talking about this year.
I wouldn't say, not on field production, Brent. Like, yeah. I want him to have a fully healthy year working every day in practice, getting his legs back under him and being able to compete on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest thing for Jabron for me. Cause like you said, Brian, like he's barely played in 2 years, right? So like, I need to get his legs underneath of him, and I want to see him just kind of get through the season and remain healthy. And I think now that you're maybe a little more optimistic about when Logan Diggs will get back to the team, now you have your three backs in front of him where you don't have to force Jabron Payne into early playing time, because I think that's, I don't want to say it's the worst case scenario for him, but I really just want to make sure that we're not rushing him back too quick.
Right. Next question. Irish Hightown says, Brian, has anyone on offense surprised you early on? I'm not the person to ask that question to. I'll tell you what, Irish Hightown, Sean Stiers and Vince D'Addario have both been at every practice so far. I have not been in any practices. Tonight at 6 o'clock p.m., ask them that question, and I will give them a heads up that you are going to ask that if you're able to be on that show. That's the deal. And hey, I'd appreciate y'all if you're in the chat and you see us doing this and something happens to the message board, please don't text me that something's wrong with the message board. I can't do anything about it right now. So the people that handle our site, getting updates when things are going wrong, they're working on fixing it. Okay. So there's nothing I can do about it in the middle of a show. Josh Phillips, Ryan, this is a good question for you. Josh Phillips, how big of a learning curve from center to left guard? And this is referring to Jarrett Patterson from earlier. How big of a learning curve is that move?
I mean, it's a difference, right? I mean, anytime you make a position switch, there's going to be things that are going to be very different. But I think if anything, Josh, I think it's going to help him in a lot of ways, right? Like we talked about just the fundamentals of snapping and getting into your blocking position and stuff. I think that the game has the opportunity to slow down a little bit for Jarrett Patterson at left guard, if we're being completely honest. So it's going to be a little bit of a transition because he's been doing something for a long period of time. But when you're talking about the switch from center to left guard, I think things are just going to be a little bit easier for Jared. You know, you have Jawalt next to you, potentially. You have Zeke Correll next to you. You have a little bit more help. There's going to be a lot of times where, honestly, you're uncovered and you have a little bit more space to navigate and you have a little bit more time to recover. And I think that the game is really, in my opinion, I think it's going to really slow down for Jarrett Patterson because it's just the process is a lot easier, I think, from a guard perspective comparative to a center. A lot of stuff happens in a very short amount of time after you have to snap and then get into your proper position.
Yeah. Another thing, guys, we go over an hour today before we get to questions. So when we start questions, we're not starting questions at the time you get to them. We are going to work through questions as we go. So you don't need to put a super chat in there about, did I see the other super chats, when we haven't got to that point yet. Okay. We will get to the questions. Okay. So just please have a little bit of patience for how we do this show on a daily basis. We'll get to questions. Okay. We'll get to those questions. We have a super chat from Fat Fish. If you projected what team, thank you, Fat Fish, for your super chat. I appreciate that very much. If you projected what team moving forward will be Notre Dame's biggest impediment to a national championship, that was going to be, I would imagine, well, I look at it twofold, Ryan. One is nationally. That's an interesting question. Then two, schedule-wise, because I actually have an interesting answer for this one.
Okay. Do you want me to tackle the schedule or the national perspective
both.
First?
Both. Okay. Either one. Whichever one you're more comfortable to kind of answer right away.
I think the answer to both is the same, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. I think it's Ohio State, because when I'm thinking about the progress and the impact in the Midwest, that is the Midwestern power that you need to overtake from a recruiting perspective and from a perception perspective. Like, that's what, when people talk about the power in the Midwest, I think that they think about Ohio State early on. Mm-hmm. So Ohio State's a big first game, best team on your schedule this year as of right now, barring what happens if they make it to the playoffs or whatever, you know, after the season happens. But also, Brian, like, I would argue that Ohio State is your biggest competition regionally from a recruiting perspective too. So I would argue that
Ohio State may be the big, I don't want to call them a hindrance, but they're the biggest competition that you have to not only to solidify yourself as the power in the Midwest and eventually taking that step forward to being a national title contender on a year-to-year basis.
Right. We've talked about this. Ohio State, to me, is a team that you've got to surpass them before you can surpass Bama and those type of teams. There's no doubt about it. And they're going to have more and more battles in the recruiting trail moving forward than they have in the past. From a schedule, so nationally, I think that is the one. You can't become the national team, you know, that you've been in the past until you be – like when Notre Dame was dominant in the 80s and 90s, they were the best team in the Midwest. The second best team in the Midwest was Michigan, and Notre Dame won most of those battles during that stretch from 88 to 93. I'm actually going to go back and look at what the schedule was, but you have to be able to beat that. Like, you know, what we often forget in that kind of that 88 to 89 schedule when Notre Dame was really good, Notre Dame over 2 years went 24-1 and had like 12 wins over ranked opponents and had like, I think like eight of them or nine of them over like top 10 teams and like seven or eight like wins over top five teams. What people forget is Michigan was really good those 2 years. Like Michigan had a really good team those 2 years. And I think when I kind of look at it, it's like, boy, you had to be able to beat Michigan or that Miami game doesn't matter. Right. I mean, it just wouldn't have mattered. In 1988, Michigan was the number four team in the country. We've talked about this last week. Their two losses that year were a 2-point loss to Notre Dame and a 1-point loss to Miami. That was it. I mean, that was a really good Michigan team. And 1989, Michigan went 10-2 and finished in the top 10 as well. And their only two losses were to Notre Dame at home by five. And then they lost the Rose Bowl to Michigan to USC by a touchdown. So those are some really good teams. And Notre Dame was able to kind of overcome Michigan during that stretch. And if you look at it, when you look at that stretch from 1988 to 1993, from 87 to 93, Notre Dame went 5-1-1 against Michigan during some times when Michigan was a really, really good football team. And so, you know, Bo Schembechler obviously retired in 1989. They beat him the last two times they played him. Then Gary Moeller took over as the coach. You know, he had some good football teams as well. Coach Moeller was the head coach during that stretch to 93. They went 9-3 and finished in the top 10 in 90. They went 10-2 and finished in the top 10 in 91. They went 9-0-3 and finished fifth in 1992. And then 1993 was the first year that they kind of took a step back and they went 8-4. So Michigan was really good during that stretch, and Notre Dame went 5-1-1 against them. And it's similar, and they were beating them on the recruiting trail for guys too. So that's what Ohio State is now to Notre Dame. You have to start beating Ohio State before you can then go do those other things. I think the other team that I look at from a schedule standpoint, Ryan, is Miami.
It's an interesting one.
Yeah, because Notre Dame and Miami are going to have some games coming up, and it's going to come during a time when Notre Dame is going to be really good. But I think if Mario Cristobal is doing what I think he's going to do as a coach, I think Miami's going to start getting pretty good here pretty soon as well. Yeah. Notre Dame plays Miami for the first time in 2024. It'll be at home, but I think Miami's going to be a pretty talented team by then. They play again in 2025 at Miami. And that's going to be what? Fourth year of Mario Cristobal's tenure. It'll be his team by then. Yeah. It'll be a much more talented team than it is now. And then I think there's another matchup coming up like a couple years after that. I'd have to go back and look kind of what their schedule is going to look like after that. Yeah, they play again in 2028. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think Miami could be that team here over the next few years where, you know, if Notre Dame, people say, look, once the 22 and 23 and 24 recruiting classes show up, well, Miami's going to have some pretty darn good recruiting classes during then too. And I'm actually more concerned about Miami in those years than I am about USC. Cause I don't, honestly, my prediction is I think the only way Lincoln Riley is at USC by 2027 is if he is not doing well, because then the NFL doesn't want him. That's my thought. That's my two cents on it.
That's interesting, because I think that also what Miami has going, I think what Notre Dame has going for right now is that you have a coach that's incredibly appealing, right? Like it's very attractive. He's making the program more attractive in that regard. Miami, when Miami's going good, the U sells itself very easily, right? Because it's like that's the brand that they have. And then also, quietly, I feel like people don't talk about this, Brian, but Miami's a good school. Like, academically, it's a good school, you know what I mean? So, like, you have
a lot of attractive things about Miami too. So if their coaching staff can do the right kind of steps, take the right steps to getting Miami back to any types of relevance, then I think that although Cristobal is a great recruiter just to start with, it's also like the brand's going to keep selling itself, right? Because everyone wants to put the U up, right? Oh, the U is back type of thing. And I think that that's a team. Texas is another one in that similar vein, right? Like Texas kind of sells itself a little bit when everything's going well. Like, you know, Texas is back, horns up, all that type of stuff. I mean, so I think Texas, Miami, a couple of those teams that are traditionally some of the blue bloods in college football that have kind of fallen to the wayside now have better images, I think, moving forward. So to your point, could be interesting national-wise.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really good stuff, Ryan. I think that's what's fun is there's – and here's the other thing, too. Someone in 5 years is going to be in this conversation that we're not even thinking about right now.
Yep.
And I don't know who that's going to be, but it's
maybe,
just –
Maybe it's Florida's coming back with Billy Napier. Maybe it's a knockout.
In 2010, if I'd have told you, Ryan, 5 years – Clemson's going to be that team. You'd have laughed at me. You're like, dude, they're an adjective, right? Yes. Like you'd have been like, you're in 2012. If I would have told you that, you'd have laughed at me. Hey, in 4 years, Clemson's going to have a title. They're going to own Bama. And that's it's just like, you'd be like, dude, okay, I'm going to have to find a new job because I can't work for an idiot. Like, I'm sorry. And you'd have been justified at the time. You just never know. Right. You just never know. Like when Dabo got hired in 07, were you thinking like in a decade from now, he's going to have two titles? And he'll have one title and be on the verge of another and have national. You know, you wouldn't have thought that. They hadn't won. Like, if you think Notre Dame's national title drought was long right now, imagine what Clemson's was. I mean, in 2015, they hadn't won one since like what, 81?
Yeah.
You know, it had, and that was, I think, their only one. I think I could be wrong on that, but it had been a long time. So you just never know. So, like, you know, when I look at their 2028 schedule, for example, you know, it's Arkansas, Purdue, Virginia Tech, Navy, Boston College, Clemson, Miami, and Pitt. I have no idea what those teams are going to be then. The only one that I think I have any kind of semblance of is Miami, because I feel like that's kind of going to be when they're going to really be rolling with Mario Cristobal. I don't know what Arkansas is going to look like. I don't know what Purdue is going to look like, or Virginia Tech, or Boston College, or Clemson, or Pitt. I don't have any clue. But it's gonna be very interesting.
Virginia Tech's another interesting one. Not quite to that level, but I kind of like the new coach they have, the defense coordinator from Penn State that's over there now. Is it Brent Pry?
Brent Pry.
Mm-hmm. I kind of like him, man. I listened to a few of his interviews. I'm like, oh, okay. At first, I was kind of like, I don't know about that hire, but now kind of looking back at it, like, not a bad hire, I think, for Virginia Tech. Yeah. We'll see, though. We'll see.
Yeah, they just need someone to get them back to getting the best kids in Virginia and, you know, that they can get, and then playing with an attitude. Justin Fuente, those teams did not play with an attitude
at all.
It's going to be, I want them to be good. I mean, I'm a Virginia guy, right? Like I want UVA and Virginia to be good. I enjoyed it when they've had good teams in the past, but I also think it's good for the ACC and good for college football. I mean, Virginia Tech should be a better team. Will they be what they were under Michael Vick? No, unless they get another Michael Vick. They won't be that again, but they were a good team for some years, you know, and
sure were really, you know, them really well. I mean, Frank Beamer, Bud Foster, yeah. It was really good. It was really good for a while. Yeah,
no doubt. Michael S with a super chat. He goes, compare BK and Mark Richt, both rebuild famous program, but unable to win the big game, go to school in fertile recruit area to change the scenario. Same result. Huh. I think it's a little bit different. Honestly, Michael, because I think Mark Richt was sort of done at that point in time. I think Mark Richt has a lot of interest outside of football. He does a lot of like missionary work. Like even when he was coaching, he does like a lot of things to help Christian organizations and that he doesn't ever like really brag about. You know, he would do like mission trips over the summer when he was coaching at Georgia to help, you know, build homes and shelters and stuff like that in other countries. And he's always kind of been that. And I just think he was kind of worn down by the time he was done with Georgia. I think he was worn out. I don't think Brian Kelly's worn out because I don't think he's worked hard enough to be worn out. But I think also Brian Kelly has a different mindset about it. I'm not saying it's better or worse. I just think Coach Richt was kind of tapped out. And I think the only reason he went to Miami was because it was his alma mater. I don't think there was any other school that could have got him to coach, in my opinion. I really don't. Whereas Brian Kelly would have taken any great offer he could get, any good offer he could get to leave Notre Dame. I mean, that had been true for a while. So I think the scenarios are a little bit different. In regard to that, I just I also think LSU is a better situation now than Miami was when Mark Richt went there. They were a mess, and they hadn't been Miami for a long time. I mean, LSU won a national title 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, like really three seasons ago, right? 3 years ago.
Yep.
So, and LSU is, I mean, it is still the program in the state if you do it right. So I don't think the scenarios are the same, but I'll say this to his question. I do think the results are going to be the same in that I do think Brian Kelly will lose most of the big games, but I think he'll win more big games than Mark Richt did, because the only big game that Mark Richt really won in his 2 years was over mm-hmm. Brian Kelly.
That's true. Very true. That's funny when you think about it like that, with the parallels.
Yeah. He's only there for like what, 2 years?
I think so. It was like a blink of the eye, man. Like yeah. it was just done, you know?
That was kind of a weird hire too.
Like
yeah, just he was there for 3 years. 3 years.
Because he was a very he just doesn't come off as a Miami
coach, even though he played there. That's the funny thing, right?
It is funny. Yeah. But like just he doesn't carry himself that way, you know? Like I feel like to be right. a Miami head coach, you gotta kind of have a little bit of swagger and a little bit of like right. that to you, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Mark Richt is not that guy. Mark Richt seems like a really nice person. I'm sure he's an awesome guy, yeah. but like just doesn't strike me as like a good fit with Miami, you know? Like right. just doesn't.
Right.
I think Cristobal is a way better fit there.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. And he Cristobal actually played after the U had become the U.
Yeah.
Whereas Richt was there before. It became right. that. He played in the Howard Schnellenberger era, not the Jimmy Johnson, Dennis Erickson era.
That's a great point. He definitely seems yeah. more like a Howard Schnellenberger right. to those yeah. guys.
The yes, Miami we think of as the U, the taunters, the trash talkers, the wearing the fatigues. And all, that was not the Howard Schnellenberger U. That right. was the Jimmy Johnson, Dennis Erickson U. Completely different situations.
That's a very good point.
So.
Very good
point. Yeah,
man. Really. Where did it go wrong for Miami? They were rolling there for a while, man. And then
I think the administration they went through yeah. the same thing that happened in Notre Dame after, because it happened around the same time, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And other than if not for them hiring Butch Davis, I don't think Miami has what Miami doesn't have the 01, 02 runs if Butch Davis doesn't get rehired, and it kind of brought back that, like that was their version of if Notre Dame would have hired Barry Alvarez to replace Lou, right? He would have been able to overcome those things because of who he was. And I don't think that, you know, and I just think they made some bad hires. The school didn't support football. You know, they got rid of the Orange Bowl and started playing it like, you know, Joe Robbie or wherever else. And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
you know, the school's trying to become the Ivy League of the South and all this other nonsense. And what was his name? Tad, the president, right? Like just didn't like the coaches. Yeah. And there were things being done to kind of undermine. And then, of course, you get into the cheating scandals with whether it was Luther Campbell or, you know, whether it sure. was Nevin Shapiro. It's just a lot of different things, but a lot of it just had to do with bad hires. And I think they kept trying to go to the well of former players going to fix it all, you know, and then, you know, and then, you know, Randy Shannon was a good linebacker in college and was a good defensive coordinator and pretty good linebackers coach and recruiter, but not a head coach.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's just it's never one thing, right? It's never like, It's always a combination of factors that can blow up a program like that.
That's fair.
And I think going away from being independent was something that I think hurt Miami a little bit because, you know, playing in the Big East, I don't know if that necessarily inspired kids to want to go to the U anymore the same way because, mm-hmm. you know, who goes to Miami saying, you know, when kids went to Miami in the 80s, yep. they went to Miami knowing they were going to get to play against the best teams in the country year after year after year. I mean, you know, like that 1988 Miami team, they were an independent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had to play Notre Dame, who was a great team. But a lot of people forget they started the season that year against the preseason number one team in the country in Florida State. The next week they played at Michigan. The week after that they played against Wisconsin. Now, Wisconsin wasn't good back then, but my point is they played – Wisconsin at home. Then they played Missouri. Then they played at Notre Dame. Later in the year, they played at LSU. And then they had a home game against number 8 Arkansas. And then they played BYU. Well, back in the 80s, BYU was really good. They were, that year, they went at 9-4 that year. 9-4 the year before that. They were a couple years before, 85, they were an 11-win team. And in 1984, BYU won the national championship. And so, you know, beat Michigan in a bowl, in the Holiday Bowl, opened the season with a win at number three Pitt. So, you know, beating, I mean, they were going all over the country playing everybody, you know, mm-hmm. And I mean, that's kind of why you signed up to go to Miami. I mean, it's for similar reasons that you went to Notre Dame. It's you're going to play for championships and you're going to play teams from all over the country. And yeah. I think they kind of went away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And when they joined the conference, and combined with all the other things. And then part of it too, was the emergence of Florida State. Like once Florida State kind of broke that barrier with Charlie Ward in 93, combined with Dennis Erickson was running a program that like was just like Jimmy Johnson's teams played with attitude. Mm-hmm. Dennis Erickson's team was a renegade program. There's a difference.
Yeah.
Like the Miami team in 88, they had some I mean, they had some attitudes. They had some swagger. They talked trash and all that, but they were still a disciplined, well-coached football team.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Erickson was like, I'm talking about the, you know, the inmates running the asylum or whatever expression you want to use. It's like he had no control of that team, none. And they became a, like, when I think of the U in its greatness, it ain't that.
Right.
I didn't enjoy watching that version of Miami. I was like, this is just disrespecting the game. Now, the Jimmy Johnson team that talked a ton of trash, and even the 89-90 teams that talked a ton of trash under Erickson before the Jimmy Johnson influence had been worked out of the program. I mean, now that I have respect for the 88-89 Miami teams. I do. I have respect for those teams. And Dennis Erickson was you know, part of that because he was the head coach of the 89 team, but that was still riding Jimmy's coattails, in my opinion. They would just lose games they had no business losing, like getting embarrassed by Alabama. Jimmy Johnson's team never would have got embarrassed by Alabama the way they got embarrassed by Alabama. If you remember that year, was it 92 that they played Alabama for the title and just got embarrassed by Alabama? I mean, that was the game where Lamar Thomas, who I couldn't stand, was thinking he was running for a touchdown and George Teague just hawks him and rips the ball out of his hand. Like that was that game. They had John Copeland and Eric Curry on the defensive line. You know, that team was that Bama team was physical, and Miami just thought they were just going to do what they always do, roll in there and whoop them. And it didn't happen. And they got embarrassed. And I think that was the death of Miami, in my opinion, because people didn't revere that Miami team the way that they did the previous Miami teams,
mm-hmm.
right? They didn't fear them the way they did in, you know, in the 80s under Jimmy. I just don't think that they did.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Michael S. also said fear with adding O-line adding weight is they turn into a lumbering Wisconsin type line, power but reduced speed and agility. Fast D-lines will beat them on edge plays. I mean, I think that's a legitimate fear that doesn't happen, right? I don't want to dismiss that fear. It's just I think that Matt Bayless and Harry Hiestand have earned the trust mm-hmm. of, okay, they know that, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's also about they have guys that are that big. I think mm-hmm. part of the thing that hurt Josh Lugg last year is they slimmed him down and didn't mm-hmm. let him play. Like that was Coach Quinn's philosophy. It was going to be lateral quickness, outside zones, counters. We need to move. We need to do this. We're going to be pass pro. We're going to be sleek. That's what he wanted. Mm-hmm. Harry Hiestand wants big boys. I had an article today on Irish Breakdown. The line this year is going to weigh 0.4 pounds bigger than what the 2017 line was. And you know, because it's just, but it's not because there's one 340 pounder on the lineup. It's because it's 308 and above everywhere, but no one's bigger than 327. They're like, your biggest guy that you were, that I would worry about that with, lost 8 pounds in Blake Fisher. You know, Zeke Carell getting up to 308, that's a little bit concerning, but he's a center. So, you know, and he needed to add some weight, and he'll lose five of that during fall camp. Jarrett Patterson being up to 310, totally fine with that. Josh Lugg getting up to 316, that's where he should have been anyway. I think he should be closer to 320 than he should have been to 310 like he was last year. And you and I talked before the season, before the rosters came out, I should say, that we thought Josh Alt would be around 315 because he's just got a monster frame, and he's 317. So he's in the wheelhouse of what I think his frame can carry. So, Michael, I think that's a valid concern in theory. I'm just not worried about it with this line because I don't – none of those weights to me, I looked at it and was like, whoa, that's a lot of weight for that guy to carry. I don't have those concerns in my opinion.
I think because the one other thing that you said, Brian, is that it's going to be a very long offensive line too. Right. So I think these body types can hold that type
6'7", 6'8", guys. Right. Exactly. Well, their starting lineup is going to be your three biggest guys weight-wise. 327 is Blake Fisher, but he's 6'6". Joe Walt is 317, but he's over – he's almost about 6'7". Yep. Josh Lugg is 316. He's over 6'7". So it's not like he's 316 at 6'2", right? And some of the videos that I've been sent and the pictures I've been sent by Vince, these guys don't look puffed up, meaning like bigger than they should be. They look like they're linemen carrying natural good weight. There's not guts. There's not bellies. They're just bigger because that's the philosophy that Harry Heistand wants. So you're going to change your strength conditioning program to be more about explosiveness and short area power and finishing than it's going to be about conditioning and endurance and those kind of things.
All due respect to the Ohio State offensive line, but there are a couple players in that line that look like they should not be carrying as much weight as they hold, and Notre Dame does not look like that.
And that's the thing you brought up. Like, if I see Emil Wagner next year at 310, I'm going to be worried.
It's a problem. Yeah, it's a problem.
Like, dude, that kid should not be carrying 310 at any point, much less this early. And that was the thing that you've brought up a lot with Nicholas Pettit-Frere is he should have been 295, 300 and playing at that weight instead. Like Robert Hainsey did.
Or whatever,
like Notre Dame never tried to pump up Robert Hainsey to be 315. Now, they could have put over, they could have got him over 300 pounds if they wanted to, but his body couldn't handle that. Jarrett Patterson at 310 does not look 310 because he's got a really thick, broad shoulders, you know, like thick lower body. He's got the frame to carry it. Same with Josh Lugg, same with Joe Walt, same with Blake Fisher. So, Michael, in theory, you make a good point. But the Wisconsin guys were always pumped up to be that. They had a bunch of Mike McGlinchey types, in my opinion, where those guys were going to lose weight once they got done playing football because they had to put that extra weight on them because they weren't naturally that big.
Like the I think these guys are right.
Yeah, right. Because how quickly did Joe Thomas get down to like 250? Like within like a year of him being done playing football?
Yeah.
Whereas with some of these Notre Dame kids, it's going to be like when Quentin Nelson stops playing football, my concern with guys with his body type is I hope he doesn't put on weight. When he's not working out as much as he is, because he's just such a naturally big guy.
Yeah, he's always going to be a big dude. Like, exactly. I agree completely.
Right. Now, nowadays, guys, you know, have much more sense of nutrition and things like that. And Quentin's still going to be working out as long as the devastating injury. So, you know, he'll be smart enough to know I got to change my diet and I can't eat like I used to eat and that kind of thing. Which maybe back in the day, guys didn't quite as have much of the knowledge of just that type of thing. But, you know, so, but he's going to be a guy that's Alex Barr is always going to be big. Blake Fisher is always going to be big. Joe Walt, when he gets done playing football, is still going to be big. He's going to be bigger than Mike McGlinchey. He's just bigger than, just naturally bigger than Mike McGlinchey. Whereas we've said, Mike McGlinchey is going to lose a lot of weight when he stopped playing football. Joe Thomas immediately lost a lot of weight because, again, it was that puffed up. He was bigger than what his body necessarily was designed to be, although he never got to the point where he was bigger than he could handle. But as you said, though, he was never that much more over 300 pounds, as you pointed out. If he'd have got up to 315, 320, that would have been a problem, and that when a movement set in. So it's different for each kid, Michael, but I think it's a very fair thing to question, right? When you see guys gaining 15-plus pounds in one offseason, that's a concern. But I also think the other part is don't always assume that what they were listed at last year, which is where the weight gains are being based off of, is necessarily an accurate weight. Like, I don't think Michael Mayer was only 251 last year. I think he was bigger than that last year. So I don't think he necessarily gained 15 pounds this offseason. I think he probably gained like 8 or 9. I just, you know, I think the 251 was kind of more closer to maybe what he was the year before. Notre Dame wasn't great at updating their rosters in the past, to be completely honest with you. And I think they're doing a better job of that now. So that's my two cents on that one. Like Billy Shrouth was not 274 in March, and he's 302 now.
Right.
He was 274 when he visited like a year before that in high school. You know what I mean? So
is he 302? Wow.
That's what he was.
I missed that one. Yeah. Wow. Nice.
Yeah. Yep.
That's good. Absolutely. That's good weight, man. That's a really good weight.
Yeah, it is. And he got it this quickly, and he looks good. He's got a little bit of a gut that he's got to work off. So that was actually good to see that, because if he's 302 and he still hasn't completely reshaped his body, that's a positive sign to me.
Yes.
Yep. And yes, Michael, we did have your two super chats, but they weren't quite up in the queue just yet. So, but thank you for those questions. Here's a good one. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say this is more for his career as opposed to 2022. Mm-hmm. ICURN with Irish Luck with a super chat. Thank you. Do you think Tyler Buchner could be a Vince Young type from run and throwing? Vince was accurate, but with a weird throwing motion.
I mean, look, they're very different players, obviously, from a physical perspective, just from a play style perspective. But could they have a similar impact? Yeah, it's possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, to your point earlier, Brian, when we were talking about, you know, Tyler Buchner, that he needs to be the dude at points this season for them to be really successful. The one thing about Vince Young at Texas, especially his last year, I mean, you think about the USC game, for instance, right? When it was the biggest moment, he was 100% at his best, and he put the team on his back. And yep. It was a talented team, but like in the big moments, Vince Young was making the play. You know what I mean? So that's yes, I think that he could have a similar impact in that regard if he hits a ceiling. I do.
Yeah, I think the, you know, again, I'm trying to not compare him to Vince Young overall, because I think they're very different players. They're very different type of athletes. And I always think it's really unfair to compare a kid that's thrown 30 some passes to a guy that I thought had one of the greatest individual seasons I've ever seen in Vince Young in 2005. And he's pretty good in 04. I mean, his Rose Bowl performance against Michigan at the end of the 04, I think it was 04 season, that was just brilliant. But like you said, Ryan, I think the impact can be there. The run throw ability can be there. The dynamic thing where he can run for 150 just as easily as he can throw for 300. Where I would say is I think Vince was a smooth runner. I would say I actually think Tyler is a more natural passer than Vince was, though. Vince became a better passer. He had to learn that, though. I think Tyler already had that. I mean, again, we're talking about a kid that threw for almost 4,500 yards as just a junior in high school. So right. I think he has a little bit more of that, in my opinion.
Don't disagree. A little bit different of a runner as well. Vince was kind of like a glider, while Tyler, yeah, I'd say, was a little more explosive and right, physical, you know?
Right. Yep. Yeah. Cover a lot of ground where he didn't look like he was that fast, but, you know.
Vince Young looked like a tight end, man. Like, he just glide on you, though. It's like, oh, right, that guy's deceptively fast, you right, know?
Right. Let's get to some more questions here. Do you think the Ohio State coaching staff is nervous about the physicality and lines that Notre Dame will have? I would say no, they're not nervous. I think they nervous. When I think nervous, I think it's almost like a fear. Yeah. I don't think that's how their coaches operate. I think they're they know that that's the thing that could give them problems if they're not prepared for it and have answers for it. But I wouldn't call right, it a nervousness, Ryan. I think it's they know that that's the strength of this football team, and they have to have an answer for it. Doesn't mean that they'll be able to come up with one. You know, like, look, USC and NC State and Michigan State and all those teams knew they needed to stop Notre Dame's run game in 2017. Didn't mean they could do it, you know, but they knew they got to do it.
Yeah, nervousness definitely has a weird connotation to it, because, I mean, I think that the Ohio State has a good staff, I think. You know, I think they have good coaches there, and I don't think that nervous is the right connotation for sure, it, because it's, I mean, they're competitors, right? Like, they're not going to just right, be like, oh, my God, I can't believe Notre Dame's going to come in and run the ball on us. Right. Like, that's not what Jim Knowles is thinking in his mind, right? Like, they're right, competitors at their core. So I agree with you. I don't think nervousness is the right,
right,
observation, but I would say, I mean, preparation wise, I think it would be nearsighted not to expect that Notre Dame is going to be a much more physical right, team. Sure. But you're not sure, nervous about that. It's just part of your preparation.
One of the questions or one of the comments that was made during the show was, well, how much of an impact can Harry Hiestand really have in his first game? And I think huge, quite a bit. I mean, you know, like, number one, I think the big thing that in regard to that comment is it depends on what the talent level that they're going to have is, number one. Mm-hmm. And the talent level is really good. Sure. And then the second one is does he have an offensive coordinator that believes in the things that he believes in? And the answer is, well, yeah, definitely, because Tommy Rees is the one that pursued Harry Hiestand to come back. And so talent is there, mindset's there. Yeah, I think he can have an impact in game one. And Notre Dame was a pretty mediocre run team in 2011. You know, they averaged, 160 yards per game. And that year, if you remember, they had a couple games where they like puffed up their stats and went for 287 against Purdue, who wasn't good. They went for 266 against Air Force, 212 against Maryland. But they had three other games they were under 100 yards, including two games they were under 60. They had 114-yard performance. They ran for 117 yards against South Florida. They were not a very good running team. Just like last year, they weren't a really good running team. They went out in 2012, and they rushed for – it ended up being 189 yards per game. A lot of that was because they only rushed for like 30 against Alabama. They were over 200 going into that game, and they ran for at least 214 yards six times that year in the regular season. Actually, I'm sorry, seven times that year, including 293 yards and five touchdowns in the first game of the year against Navy. It was a decent team that year. So, yeah, I think he can make an impact right away. I mean, I think that's the expectation that he makes an impact because the talent is there. And the other thing, too, is that 2012 offensive line that had 293 against Navy and 376 against Miami and 150 on a really good Stanford defense, 270 against BYU, 215 on the road against Oklahoma, 231 against Pitt, 184 against Boston College, 221 against Wake Forest, and 222 against USC. That was with Mike Golick at guard. Braxton Cave coming on, who's an okay player coming off of a major injury the year before, and Christian Lombard. And yeah. You were pretty good on you were really good on the left side with Chris Watt and Zach Martin. But look, Michael Golick Jr. played his butt off that year. I'm not trying to take a shot at Mike Golick Jr., but I think Mike Golick Jr. would tell you he's not in the same league as Blake Fisher and Joe Alt and Jarrett Patterson and guys like that. It's just a God-given talent. He was a tough kid, smart kid who knew how to play the game. Yeah. And he had some ability. All right, Christian Lombard is not Blake Fisher.
Sure.
Right? I mean, he's just not. So, and with all due respect to Zach Martin, who's a great player, he wasn't 6'7", 317 like Joe Alt is. So I think the talent across the board is way better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just – and the difference, too, is they were making a scheme change in 2012. They were a pin and pull team in 10 and 11, first 2 years under Brian Kelly. And then when they brought in Harry to replace Ed Warner – they switch from being a pin and pull team to a zone counter team. They're not making a schematic adjustment this year. They'll have some wrinkles, but like they'll probably run a little bit more duo this year, but they've been running duo. They're going to keep running the same concepts. They may add a buck sweep, but they've already had buck sweep in their system. So I think that's the other thing to factor in too, is he's not having to make the scheme change that he made in 2012. So yeah, I think he can definitely make a big difference in his first, not just first year, but first game. I do believe that. Here's a good question from DC Irish 1213. Do you guys think our size on the defensive line can cause any problems? I thought that this was the intent from a recruiting perspective to get more athleticism. So Ryan, I think I would like for you to answer that twofold.
Okay.
Number one is do you think Notre Dame's size can cause problems for them? And what are the scenarios in which their size, being what it is, can cause problems for other people?
Sure. Yeah, I think if I tackled the second part first, I mean, the quick answer is that this defense, which was laid out by Marcus Freeman, is going to be accentuated by an Al Golden, is going to be an attack style defense. And not attack style in the sense that there's going to be a lot of blitzing, attack style in the sense that the defensive line is going to do a lot of one gap stuff, right? So mm-hmm. They are going to be a penetration style team. So when you have those smaller frames, but that quickness that you have with the defensive line that you have, when you have the Howard Crosses of the world, the Jason Adamololas, that style of defensive tackle, you can cause a lot of issues from a penetration perspective. You can kind of slip through cracks, create penetration, create tackle for loss numbers, do all that type of stuff, right? So that's where I think the biggest plus is from the size perspective. The negative is that if those guys get caught in, let's say, a down block, for instance, or a double team, you don't have as much to anchor as if you were a 300-plus pounder. Like, that's the negative, right? So the biggest negatives for me, again, is that in certain situations, you're going to get caught where your size is going to be a debilitating factor against certain things. Double teams, down blocks, that type of thing. But with how Notre Dame wants to play defense up front, I think in a one-gap penetration style team, that's where the size, but the added quickness and explosiveness is a big bonus in that regard.
Yep. Agree. Good answer to that. Here's one at Irish Hightown. Ryan, does Tyler Buckner have the potential to be in the conversation for the Heisman?
I think it's a little, we talked about this the other day. I think it's a little premature for 2022 to expect a redshirt freshman. And I know, again, I get, or a sophomore, I guess, whatever you want to call it. I understand that we are dealing in a world where Bryce Young last year was in his second year, won a Heisman.
And we've seen it a lot. I mean, it's,
we have seen it. It's been increased. I mean, Jameis Winston going back, Johnny Manziel, like we've seen it more regularly. There's no doubt. I will say, though, I just don't think that this offense is going to function where you're going to see gaudy passing numbers to the degree of some of those other guys that have kind of gone through. So I think that it's going to be – I think that Tyler Buckner has a chance to have a great season, Irish Chi-Town. I just would not expect Heisman this first year, right? Like 2023, if everything is going the way and you're kind of projecting and going about it the way that you think you can from a – just momentum perspective, then maybe 2023 is the Heisman campaign for Tyler Buckner. Mm-hmm. But I also don't think you need him to be a Heisman Trophy candidate for this team to be successful this year.
So we have this question here, and it's from Mr. Sanders. And the question is about size and the offensive line and size. And the question is does how does Notre Dame's size compare to the 2012 team? Mm-hmm. So I will answer that question. Notre Dame's left tackle going into 2017 or 2022 is 6'7", 317 pounds. Notre Dame's left tackle in 2012 was 6'4", 304. Notre Dame's left guard going into the 2022 season is 6'4 and a half, 310 pounds. Notre Dame's guard going into the 2012 season was 6'3", 310, and Chris Watt is not 6'3". Notre Dame center going into that, you know he's not.
I know he's not.
Notre Dame center going into the 2022 season is about 6'2", 308. Their center in 2012 was 6'3", 304, similar. Notre Dame's right guard going into 2020 is over 6'7", and 316 pounds. Notre Dame's right guard in 2012 was how tall was he? 6'3", 300 pounds. Mm-hmm. Notre Dame starting right tackle going into 2022 is 6'6", 327. Notre Dame's right tackle going into the 2012 season was 6'5", 309. So significantly bigger team, bigger team. Notre Dame's biggest offensive lineman in 2012 by weight was Chris Watt at 310. He would be tied for fourth on the current lineup.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, it's definitely a bigger line and a taller line, a thicker line, I would argue more athletic line too. So, mm-hmm. Now, will it be as good as the 2012 line? Remains to be seen. Sure. But I expect it to, but the talent is certainly there. So it's a very, very talented group to deal with, no doubt about it. All right, we have one last super chat here. I think this is the last one. I'm going to go kind of look through some of the others just to make sure I didn't miss any. But Travis asks, do you guys think that Notre Dame being a double-digit dog to Ohio State is justified? And do you guys think Notre Dame will be the favorite when Clemson comes to town? So, Ryan, we did talk about the first part last week, but I do want you to address that. Do you think it's justified? Because I think the answer is yes and no.
Yeah, it's twofold for me. One, Notre Dame has not played great in bigger games recently, right? For the most part. So I understand why the line is what it is. But I also believe that you don't hold people to previous eras, right? Like if you're going to continue to do that to Brian Kelly-based teams, I get it. Because that's like kind of been his crutch, his kryptonite while he was at Notre Dame, right? This is a brand new coaching staff. I think the talent is not far off when you're just kind of looking like a full roster perspective. So I do think the 15.5 is not justified, if I'm being completely honest. I would rather have been somewhere between 7.5 to 9, right, as far as Ohio State being a favorite. And I would have just looked past it and been like, Notre Dame is a significant underdog in this game still, but I understand where the line's coming from. I think 15.5 is not justified, though. Mm-hmm. I think it's ridiculous, if I'm being completely honest with you, right? The second question is just hard for me to answer, Travis, because I don't know what Clemson looks like going into that game. Sure. I don't know what Notre Dame looks like going into that game. Maybe.
Let me have you look at it like this. Okay. Sure. So we're making the comments we're making about Notre Dame because of how we view the two Notre Dame teams going into the season. Because you're saying that it's not justified based on what you expect Notre Dame to be. If Isaiah Foskey would have gone pro and Jared Patterson would have gone pro and Brandon Joseph doesn't transfer in and Cam Hart would have gone pro and Michael Mayer wasn't around, you know, we'd be like, yeah, I actually hope they can keep it within 15 of that. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of part of it. So we're projecting into the game one. I know you don't know where they're going to be in November. But just projecting what you think that these teams will be this year, how about you try and answer it that way? Because I understand where you're coming from. Like, dude, that's like 10 games in the year, right? Like, nine games. I'll say this. So go that way.
I'll say this, Brian, and I don't know if you'd agree or disagree with this. I think that there's a possibility that Notre Dame is favored in that game if Notre Dame is off to a solid start and Ohio State is a good team, but not maybe quite as good as they have been in recent years, maybe a closer version, maybe a slightly better team than they were last year, right? Like, I think that's possible. I'll say this, though. If Notre Dame does not beat Ohio State in the first game, then I think Clemson is going to be the favorite regardless. Because there's still going to be that stigma around the pro. Even if Notre Dame only has that one loss, they look fantastic leading up to the Clemson game. And let's say Clemson even has a loss or two. Even if Notre Dame has a better record, I still think Clemson will be favored, even though it's at Notre Dame. Because I still think if they lose to Ohio State, there's going to be this perception Notre Dame can't beat the good teams, right? They can't beat the big programs. So I do think it's kind of dependent upon the Ohio State game, even more than the full resume, to whether Notre Dame is favored, because I think there is still going to be a stigma around them.
So I have a couple different takes on this, Ryan. Number one is the 15.5 justified from the standpoint of what Notre Dame even was last year and what Ohio State was last year? If we're going to project to back to last year, then no, it's not justified, because Ohio State played like, what, three good teams all year, four good teams all year. They blew one out. They barely beat another, and that beat Utah by, what, three? And then they got their butts kicked, almost cursed. They got their butts kicked in the other two, right? I know they only lost by a touchdown to Oregon. They got their butts kicked from the start of that game to the end of that game. That was never a game you actually thought Ohio State might actually win this. Same with Michigan. So I don't think their most recent team is a whole lot different than what Notre Dame's most recent team is, right? And so I think that it makes it a little bit unfair. I think the unjustified. I think the fact that Notre Dame has been so bad in these games is where I understand it, right? So that's partly my yes and no. But at the end of the day is, what is the spread meant to do? It's meant to create as much action on both sides as you can create. And there is no way in heck you would have got action from bettors on Notre Dame's side if it was a 7-point spread, right? You needed to get a big spread to get people to put action on Notre Dame. If it was a 1-touchdown spread, or even an 8-9-point spread, I think people would have been hammering Ohio State the whole time. I'm talking about the bettors. I think that 15.5 also was enough to start getting Notre Dame fans to start saying, I'm putting money on that one. You know what I mean? On Notre Dame side. I think because you're going to have a hard time getting bettors to go on Notre Dame. And I think they needed to go something. And this is a very, very novice, like lay opinion on this, because I'm not a gambler kind of guy. But I do think I do know what the perception of Notre Dame is, however. And I think the perception of Notre Dame is such that anything less than this spread would have made it very hard. Because if everybody bets on one side and that side wins, you don't really make a lot of money, correct? And if everybody bets on the other side and you lose, and obviously people, so you lose a ton of money, right? If I'm getting this correctly. Your best way of making money is to try to create a spread in which you get as much action as you can on both sides. Then you're going to have a better chance at winning more money. And so that's kind of how I view that one, is, again, a very like lay betting, not even betting 101. Like I'm taking like, you know, junior high classes, but that's so in that regard, I do think it's justified in that regard. But as far as just the matchup, if we're just talking what should the spread be based on the matchup, it has no business being 15.5, in my opinion.
Fair. I agree.
Because you can't give me the whole, well, I'm anticipating that, you know, it's really going to be a 9-point game and Ohio State's going to return a fumble at the end as Notre Dame's trying to score. And that's not how lines are created. It's because you think Ohio State is a 2+ touchdown better team than Notre Dame. That's what you think. And I just, there's nothing about these two teams to me that should make anyone think that that's what it should be. Because, as I said, what has Ohio State done in its most recent games against ranked opponents? Okay, they had a three-point win over a banged-up Utah team. They got curb-stomped by Michigan, beat Michigan State convincingly, got curb-stomped by Oregon, and got curb-stomped by Alabama. You know, so, I mean, they lost by 28 to Alabama last time they played. Notre Dame lost by, I say, 24, because I don't count the garbage touchdown at the end. I mean, if we're talking about how the game really played out, it was like a 24-point game. Very similar. So, I don't agree that Notre Dame should be a 2+ touchdown spread. There's also a conversation, like there's some arguing going on in the chat between Notre Dame and Ohio State fans. And one of the Ohio State people, and I don't remember who it was, talked about how Ohio State had a better rush defense than Notre Dame did last year statistically. That is such a bad argument to make. Number one, take out the option team, number one, because Notre Dame gave up 166 yards to Navy. That was like 60 yards below their that was over 100 yards, I believe, below Navy season average last year, I believe. I'm going to go look at Navy's rushing total. Last year, they were at 226. That was one of the worst seasons they've had. That's 60 below their season average.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that was one of the worst Navy rushing teams they've had in a long time. So you throw that out. The other thing, too, is you look at Notre Dame, they played much better running teams than Ohio State did. And Ohio State beat up on inferior opponents. Notre Dame had a couple bad games. I think you also look at a lot of the yards that Notre Dame gave up last year, they gave up on scrambles, not running. A lot of the yards they gave up against Oklahoma State, scrambles. Most of the yards they gave up to North Carolina in the game, they gave up 20 yards, run scrambles. They never had anybody run the ball down their throat the way that Oregon and Michigan did. Even Florida State, who ran for 264 yards, 80-plus yards of that were on an 80-plus yard touchdown, which Notre Dame stunted the wrong way in the first game of a new defensive coordinator. That is not what happened this next week against Oregon. You know, and so it's just that's a bad argument to make. I'm sorry. There's no one that watched those two teams last year that would say, oh, yeah, I'd take Ohio State's run defense over Notre Dame's. Nobody that watched those two teams. So with all due respect, I just think it's a bad argument to make, in my opinion. It's just not a good argument to make. So I did want to respond to that because I just thought that was just not one I agreed with. I don't want to go back to this answer too, Ryan. I want to address this one that you brought up earlier because I was trying to find some more, make sure I was going through the super chats to make sure I didn't miss any super chats. Mm-hmm. Does Tyler have the potential to be in the conversation for the Heisman? I understand where you're coming from, and I don't necessarily disagree with you. I'm going to just look at it from exactly how it was written, not necessarily from a setting what the expectation should be, which is what I think you are rightly doing. My whole thing is, does he have the potential to be in the Heisman conversation? Yes. He does. On a very basic answering your question, does he have the potential? Yes, he does. Tyler Buchner has the potential, in my opinion, to go out next year and run, pass for 3,000 yards, rush for 800 plus yards, have 40 plus touchdowns, and lead Notre Dame in the playoff. He has the potential to be that guy next year. And if he does that and Notre Dame's a playoff team, guess what? He's in the Heisman conversation, in my opinion. Why? Because he's at Notre Dame. As I said, 2 years ago, Ian Book finished like ninth in Heisman voting, and he threw for like barely over 2,000 yards and had 15 passing touchdowns in 12 games. And he was in the Heisman conversation. And so if Tyler Buchner is like a 3,000 plus yard guy, or if he goes like for 28 and 1,000, you know what I mean, Ryan? Like it doesn't have to, however, is he in the conversation? Yeah. Will his impact be the same as what Bryce Young had the year before at Alabama? Probably not. Because the Heisman is not necessarily about, are you the third best player in college football? It's a perception thing. But if Tyler Buchner has a couple big spotlight games, right? Because here's the deal, Ryan. If he has a great game against Ohio State and then plays about three or four kind of mediocre-ish games in between, but he still puts up numbers, and then he has a big spotlight game against Clemson, he's going to be in the Heisman conversation because they're not going to watch all those other games. The voters aren't going to watch all those other games. They're going to see he played great in these two games and he had good numbers and Notre Dame is good.
Right.
So he'll be in there. Will it be justified? I think we can have a different conversation there, but even there, I think his talent is such that he could be there.
Sure.
But I don't think I don't think the supporting cast is good enough for him to put up the monster numbers that other quarterbacks are going to put up to be in that conversation. But if Notre Dame beats Ohio State, that's the other thing. That's the final piece. It's got to include either a win over Ohio State or a loss in which he puts up stupid numbers.
Yeah.
But I would say if he puts up stupid numbers, I think they win. But if he puts up like 320 yards passing and 100 yards rushing and they lose a shootout that looks a lot like the Rose Bowl, then he could be in it as long as Notre Dame runs the table and he keeps playing really well. Mm-hmm. But that would be it. But again, I'm not predicting that. I think that's a lot to put on a first-year player in a system that's not geared towards – like, he's going to have to make a lot more plays than with his body than Bryce Young made with his body, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Bryce Young was a great quarterback because of what he did with his mind, you know, as sure. much as he did what he did with his body. Tyler's going to have to do things with his mind as well, but they're going to count on him if this team's going to be a playoff team to do things that Bryce Young could never dream of doing because they're going to be about making dynamic plays with his body. So I think if he's doing that, and that's the final element, Ryan, his numbers won't put him in the conversation. I think you and I both know if Notre Dame is undefeated or 11-1 with a shootout loss to Ohio State, I still believe that a lot of voters look at stats and highlights. Mm-hmm. And his numbers could be way away from Bryce Young and CJ Stroud, but none of them are going to have the highlight plays that Tyler Buchner is going to make.
That's fair.
Right? And to me, that's that. If that combined with good numbers and Notre Dame being in the championship race is to me what could have him in that conversation. So is he have to? So it's about potential. If you'd have said, Ryan, will Tyler Buchner be in the conversation for the Heisman? I'd say no. It's too early for that. But because you said the word potential is why I changed my answer. So I kind of feel like Ryan, you answered it from a will he type of mindset. Mm-hmm. And I totally am on board with you. I just wanted to give a kind of a counter argument just to kind of say, you know, if we're just going to look at potential, I could see a scenario in which he's in that conversation. I'm just not predicting it. So it's, oh, Driscoll said Tyler Buckner's going to be in the Heisman conversation. I'm not saying that.
That's what I heard.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying, is there potential for it? Sure. Sure. What if I'd have told you before last year, hey, CJ Stroud's going to be in New York at the end of the season, would you be like, oh, yeah, okay, it makes total sense?
If Brian Driscoll said it, I believe you.
All right, Ryan and I gotta have a talk, everybody. We gotta get off the show. Yeah. So anyway, that's gonna do it for today's show, everybody. This was a long one, but it didn't feel like it was this long because we covered so many different topics. It was a lot of fun. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Great participation, great for the most part, good conversation over there. Alan Watson, so three Heismans and three Natties, right, Ryan? See, this is how it goes. You guys are trying to turn me into Beano Cook. You guys, I'm going to tell you. But anyway, fun show today, everybody. And thank you all so much. Appreciate you guys being in the chat today. And appreciate you listening to the show. As we always ask, give us a like. Hit that subscribe button. Hit the notification bell. Share this podcast. Have a great rest of your day. 6 o'clock tonight, 6 p.m. Obviously, the IB Nation Sports Talk Show will be going live with Sean Stiers and Vince D'Addario. They're back on schedule this week. They're going to be talking about practice because they were both at practice this morning. So that's why we are not talking a lot about practice because we weren't there. We're going to let the people that were there talk about that. And they're going to talk about that tonight at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern on the Irish Breakdown channel. So the IB Nation Sports Talk. And they'll obviously be back again tomorrow. We'll be back tomorrow at 1 o'clock because we're going to talk about the defense and the stars that need to play like stars on defense. And that's going to lead to a lot of interesting conversation about specific games. And, of course, talking Ohio State, talking Clemson, USC, it's going to make for a very, very interesting conversation. So I hope you all will join us for that. But be with our guys tonight. Tonight, 6 o'clock, Sean Stiers, Vince D'Addario are going to talk about practice and Notre Dame quarterbacks. Should be very, very interesting. So thank you all very much. Have a great rest of your day, and we will talk to you all again very, very soon on the Irish Breakdown Podcast.
Mm-hmm.